Hello, podcast listeners. A quick notice before we get started with today's episode of Emperors of Rome. This episode was recorded in front of a live Zoom audience under lockdown conditions in Melbourne, as always, so that's why it's a little bit longer, and towards the end we do take some questions from the audience. That's notice one. Notice two is that the When in Rome podcast is now fundraising for Series 6. When in Rome explores place and space in the Roman Empire, so if you've ever seen a Roman building and gone, hey, that's a nice Roman building, I wouldn't mind a podcast that can tell me a bit more about that, or hey, that's a really interesting Roman site, I wonder if there's a particular podcast that can tell me more about that, then this is the podcast for you, wonderful, nerdy people. You can find links to the fundraiser on our social media, and there'll be a link in the description of this episode. That's it for the notices. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Emperors of Rome. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Head of the Department of Languages and Linguistics at La Trobe University. This is episode CLXXIV, Boudica. In 60 CE, Rome came close to losing the province of Britannia in an uprising led by the warrior queen Boudica. He united the tribes in the area, destroyed several Roman settlements, and defeated part of a Roman legion. She has become an icon of British resistance, highlighting the difficulty Rome had in controlling the distant provinces. And speaking of icons of British resistance, welcome to the podcast, Rhiannon Evans.
Oh, if only.
It's a fair assessment, I'm sure, isn't it? I've seen your statue next to Big Ben.
Maybe one day.
All right, so shall we talk about Boudica? Let's have a quick kind of nutshell and distill. Who is Boudica and why are we doing a podcast about her?
She is a British queen. She's the queen of the Iceni, who are in modern East Anglia, so the bit of England that sticks out into the North Sea. And she sort of becomes a folk hero, certainly in the last few centuries and maybe in antiquity too, because she managed to gather together tribes close to her and leads an uprising against what is represented to us as very oppressive Roman forces. And the sources we have, which we'll talk about, are Roman or from the Roman world, and they don't represent the Romans in a particularly good light in some ways here. So it's very, very interesting what we know about her, which is not as much as we'd like to. She's sort of fascinating because partly because we fill in the gaps and she becomes this folk hero and a symbol of, I guess, ancient unity, which, spoiler, doesn't manage to stand up to the Romans for very long, but manages to kind of shame them for a while. And then becomes a symbol of the British Empire in the 19th century, which is kind of ironic because she's resisting empire. So there are lots of paradoxes there.
I was surprised when I started reading up on her and going in depth how little we know about her, and how much we know about her is just plain Tacitus or Dio making things up. Mostly Dio. I'm looking at Dio when I say that. But those are the two main sources that we're dealing with, which is Roman. I don't even want to say hostile because I think in Tacitus, there's kind of begrudging admiration, and Dio is like, ugh, girls. That's what it took from his assessment.
Dio is a primary school child, apparently. Yeah, I mean, those are the only two sources we have that talk about her, so it is perilously little. And Matt has just shown his bias there in saying that Dio makes things up. It does look fanciful. You're quite right when we get to it. It's more than Tacitus tells us, but you do wonder about whether he's done a bit of creative writing.
And Tacitus had a primary source to deal with from kind of a first-hand account?
Well, he might well have had access to the first-hand account via his father-in-law, Agricola, who was governor of Britannia a little bit later, but, you know, had been in Britannia earlier, so he would have known the people to ask. So that doesn't necessarily mean that Tacitus is more reliable in things like speeches, as we'll see. He gives us very rhetorical speeches, as does Dio.
But
he's closer in time.
Yes.
So he's maybe writing 50 or 60 years after the event, whereas Dio's a whole century later. And he also probably had more access to those who were there.
Okay, so what was the context of Romans in Britannia at that point? Was it a well-established settled province, or was it the wild frontier?
It kind of is. It's not that long in terms of the Roman Empire. You know, the Romans have sort of known about Britannia for quite a while, and famously Caesar had sailed over in the 50s BCE, twice in 55 and 54. The first time's a bit of a disaster. The second time he has a bit of a fight, makes some local contacts, but you can't say that there's been conquest. It's not part of the empire at that point. And he claims that he went over to southeast England as it is now to stop the Brits sending over help to the Gauls. It's interesting, the sources in between say, oh, there wasn't much there, so Caesar didn't want to bother, you know, nothing to be gained from invading Britannia. People like Strabo say that. But there clearly was something there they wanted. For one thing, sailing over the English Channel is like sailing over ocean, the edge of the world. And so in 43 CE, so we're talking about 17 years before the Boudicca Uprising, we have the invasion of Britannia under the Emperor Claudius. The first governor is called Aulus Plautius, and Vespasian, the future emperor Vespasian, is part of this invasion too. So it's not the whole of Britannia. It's never the whole of Britannia. So I don't know if there's anyone listening in who's in Scotland, but a lot of Scotland never gets incorporated into the province. At this point, it's basically southeast England, modern southeast England and the Midlands. And what the Romans do, which is very typical of them, is they create this series of client kingships. They're sort of independent, but under the Roman umbrella. So they kind of sign up to the Pax Romana. And one of the peoples that does this are the Iceni of, as I said, East Anglia, kind of modern Norfolk and a bit of Suffolk.
Yeah.
The king at that time is called Antidios. So he's kind of saying that he will be loyal, I guess, or be part of this Roman imperial experiment. So he will do what the Romans want. And in return, he gets support as king of the Iceni.
Sure. But, you know, at the point of a pullum kind of thing. So this is Boudicca's tribe. So what do we know about the Iceni and this situation? You've kind of just told us that they were like clients. Is that the best way to put it? They're under the Roman rule, but kind of have their tacit approval, independence kind of thing. So how does Boudicca's husband, I guess, come to be the big man of the village?
Well, there's a bit of a history there in that there had been an uprising earlier than the Boudicca uprising back in 47 CE, 4 years into the Roman invasion. The governor by this point is a man whose name I love called Ostorius Scapula. Like, he's a shoulder blade man.
He's got a chip on his shoulder.
Ironically, Tacitus says that one of the ways he describes Britannia is shaped like a shoulder blade.
Yeah, true.
Which no one really understands.
Yeah.
anyway, that's nothing to do with Ostorius Scapula. He doesn't seem to be very good at this geopolitics. He tells those in the southeast to disarm. He doesn't trust them. Okay, so there's sort of this idea that conquest will continue and work further north and further west. Ostorius says, I don't want you rising up while I'm moving around, so hand in your arms. And this is the thing that ignites the tinderbox. Mm. And Tacitus says that it's the Iceni themselves who are the instigators of an uprising, leading other tribes along with them. And he describes them at this point. This is in book 12 of the Annals, the Boudicca uprisings in book 14. He says the Iceni are a powerful people that had not been crushed in battle, having voluntarily entered into alliance with us. So your earlier crack about them being at the point of a spear, Tacitus isn't agreeing with that. He's saying that maybe they saw the future and saw that they had to throw their hand in with Rome. But he says they'd voluntarily done this. And I think this is important for Tacitus because that means they haven't been conquered. They haven't been enslaved. They sort of see themselves as partners with Rome, and now Rome has shamed them.
Mm.
So as we often see with Tacitus, he doesn't really think that the governor or the local commander has behaved very well here, and he's kind of asked for it. Anyway, so there's this uprising, but Ostorius defeats them very easily. So the Romans defeat this uprising. We can assume that the king Antidios was dispatched because we never hear of him again. And this is how Boudicca's husband, Prasutagus, comes to be the client king in charge of the Iceni. He's there from around 47 CE.
Okay. And meanwhile, in the area, the Romans are developing it, founding colonies. It becomes more Roman at that point, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's speculation that Boudica and Prasutagus may have been Roman citizens, that they were given citizenship. We don't know that. It's interesting. It's something that the Romans tended to do, but they may not have done it this early. And again, we mentioned Tacitus's father-in-law. We know about him because Tacitus wrote his biography, The Agricola, and Tacitus talks there about how the Romans building bathhouses and forums and all of these signs of Roman culture and architecture and civilization. He says, well, they think it's civilization, but actually it's part of their slavery. So Tacitus has a very cynical view of this. But yes, exactly. There's Romanization going on, at least in the obvious way of monuments. And one of the things that they do in the 50s CE is they found a colony in Colchester, modern Colchester in Essex, which they called Camulodunum, and they put a temple to the deified Claudius there. So Claudius dies in 54, Nero's now emperor, and they build a temple to the emperor, and it's massive. It's the biggest Roman temple ever built in Britannia. And this is one of the causes of unrest. The locals don't like having this marker of the emperor's divinity stamped onto their landscape. So this is one of their grievances.
How is it that the uprising began then? At what point did the Iceni get pushed too far?
There are a few things going on here. This is a period where the Roman troops are not in the southeast anymore. They've moved over to where I come from. They're trying to conquer what is modern Wales. And the ancient Welsh, the Britannic version of them, the Silures and Ordoviques, they're being a real pain to the Romans, which I, you know, it's fun for me to think of, a real thorn in their side under somebody called Caradocus. And so the Romans have kind of moved all of their forces there, and they'll end up confronting them on the island of Anglesey in a very dramatic fashion. So this is one thing that happens. The Romans aren't around, or at least their military forces aren't. Second thing that happens is Prasutagus dies. All right, so he doesn't have a male heir. Boudica and Prasutagus have daughters, two daughters. The third thing that happens is that there is local unrest because of grievances about the way that the Romans are treating the locals. Tacitus tells us just before the Boudica uprising in his narrative in the Annals in book 14, chapter 31, I'll quote, the veterans, these are the people who have been settled at Camulodunum, because Camulodunum is a colonia, which means it's a town that has Roman citizens, specifically veterans, installed there, had been driving the inhabitants from their homes and throwing them off their lands. So this is throwing people off their territory, dispossessing them, calling them prisoners of war and slaves. Delightful. And also it's the temple. So to read Tacitus's quote about the temple, Temple of Claudius, a temple erected to the deified Claudius lay before the natives' eyes like a bastion of everlasting domination. And the men chosen as its priests were pouring away whole fortunes in the name of religion. So there's all kinds of reasons to be dissatisfied with the Romans. I mentioned that the Romans are off in Wales. I must just mention that when they get to Anglesey, they're faced by these terrifying hordes. So this is a kind of foretaste of how Boudica and her troops are going to be represented, because the Druids are standing there. There are kind of women on the battlefield, and men kind of wailing and howling. The Romans are terrified, but they face them down, and then they go and destroy the sacred groves on Anglesey, which are sacred to the Druids. So there's a kind of destruction of Britannia's culture going on in North Wales. I think that this is not directly to do with what's going on, except that it's taken the new governor. They get
turnover.
Through a lot of them.
Yep.
Yeah, then they don't want to last long in Britain, apparently. This guy's called Suetonius Paulinus. Don't confuse him with the author Suetonius. It's not the same guy. So Suetonius Paulinus has his attention taken elsewhere. When Prasutagus dies, he's got quite a lot of wealth. He's got a lot of property. He leaves it to his daughters and to the emperor. This is not because he loves Nero. This is because he's frightened that the emperor will take everything from him, or the Romans will. So there's a kind of implied dig at Nero here. As Tacitus puts it, I quote Tacitus a lot because he puts things so beautifully, thinking that such an act of obsequiousness would keep his realm and household out of harm's way. So I think if I just bribe the emperor with half of my property, then things will be okay at home. Immediately Tacitus says, this did not happen. It didn't work, because immediately we get a really terrifying set of acts. I think I'll read directly from Tacitus here. This is the translation I use, is the Yardley one, the Oxford World Classics. The reverse turned out to be the case. It didn't keep them safe. So much so that the realm was pillaged by centurions. You think centurions, they're pretty high up. They should know better.
Would have thought they'd have better things to do. Yeah.
His household was pillaged by slaves as if they were spoils of war. So we keep getting this idea that the Romans are treating it like war. They're calling them captives. They're doing all of these things to make the local people feel shamed. Right at the start, Prasutagus's wife, Boudica, was flogged and his daughters raped. All the leading Iceni were divested of their ancestral property as though the Romans had been made a gift of the entire region, and the king's relatives were dealt with as slaves. It's a constant mantra of they're treating them as slaves, and they're not slaves. They shouldn't be treated this way. These are elite royal people, particularly the physical bodily harm. So the whipping of Boudica, the rape of the daughters. That, of course, is something that you could do to slaves with impunity, but this is a royal household. So from Tacitus's point of view, this is outrageous behavior on the part of the Romans.
And this is the motivation for leading to the uprising. I mean, not that you need much more, I don't think. I think that's reason enough to grab a few spears and rally a few barbarians. But Dio gives us a bit more, which seems to be the benefit of writing well after the event. Maybe some more details come to light about Seneca's finances, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, it's very much a financial motive in Dio Cassius. And I don't know. I mean, I like that theory that more has come to light, but I also think Tacitus probably did his homework. And if this was the case, he might have known of it and decided not to use it because he does want to. He really wants to set up this freedom and slavery equation that he refers to so often in his work. Anyway, Dio gives us a much less melodramatic reason. The Britons had been lent two lots of money, one by Seneca, who, as I'm sure I've said before on this podcast,
is the richest man
in the Roman world. He had lent the Britons 40 million sesterces, 10 senatorial, you know,
criteria.
That's the word.
Entry fee.
Which Dio says they didn't want this money. He's implying that Seneca just wants the interest, so he kind of forces it on them, like an overly eager loan shark. Then also one of the local officials, Roman officials, Decianus Catus, confiscates money that had been sent, and had been lent rather, by the Emperor Claudius. It's much more a financial disparity that sets this off. So the Britons are annoyed that all of this money's been called in. They can't afford it. And Boudica's also encouraging them. So Dio does say that it's Boudica encouraging them to go to war for this. But as I say, it's a much less violent and economic motive from his point of view.
So speaking of Dio encouraging the Britons to go to war, there is now in his text four chapters worth of speech from Boudica, in which, in my opinion, she shows an awful lot of knowledge about global geopolitics and the inner workings of the imperial government, and a lot of classical rhetoric as well. So very well spoken, very well educated. I'm very impressed.
She's not alone in this. The historiographical genre for the Greeks and the Romans is very much about giving great speeches. And again, I've probably repeated myself here, but Tacitus famously says that he has this particular speech. He has a copy of it, but it's no good. So he's going to give us his own version. Not particularly with regard to this, but we know that that happened. And definitely Dio is kind of showing off his rhetorical ability here in the speech that he gives Boudica. And it doesn't seem to have been seen as out of place to give to these people that you're simultaneously describing as barbarians, as having no culture, as being disorderly. So they can't get themselves together because they're all standing and shouting and wailing, and you know, their hair and their clothing is all really disorderly. But when they give a speech, suddenly it's like they've been to school with the Romans. They've learned all of the rhetorical tricks. Of course, this makes it more fun for the Greeks, in case of Dio, the Greek reader, to read that it's got these fantastical speeches. But if you give someone a speech that is rhetorically able like this, then you don't do that for just anybody. It shows that this is an important character in Dio's narrative.
So what did he say via her then? What did she say via him?
Now he's saying it via her. She has a lot of knowledge of history, or at least Rome's interactions with Northern Europe. And she talks about how previously, you know, the Britons in particular, we drove back Julius Caesar. He didn't get to invade here. And, you know, we that they call barbarians have driven them back before. She's very good at using props. So, you know, we've been slowly making our way through HBO Rome. And we talk a lot about how when people make speeches, and particularly the newsreader, there's a lot of use of the hands. Well, I think Boudicca's been given something similar here. She's got this prop. Yeah, she's got a spear, though. She's got a spear. I imagine she slams it down on the ground. Because he says of her, this is a quote, this is Cassius Dio, "She now grasped a spear to aid her in terrifying all beholders and spoke as follows." She's always terrifying, even when she's speaking to her own people. She says, "You have learned by actual experience how different freedom is from slavery." Dio's on the freedom slavery bandwagon too. "So, although some of you, through ignorance of what was better, have been deceived by the alluring promises of the Romans, yet now that you have tried both, i.e. freedom and slavery, you have learned how great a mistake you made in preferring an imported despotism to your ancestral mode of life." So go back to autonomy in the good old days. "And you've come to realize how much better is poverty with no master than wealth with slavery." That lovely balancing, poverty but no mastery, than wealth with slavery. That's very typical of Greek and Roman speech making. And as you say, there's screeds and screeds of this in Dio. She's got long, long, long speech.
She's got opinions on the emperors as well and everything. But, you know, three chapters later, finishes with a rhetorical flourish.
"Let us show them that they are hares and foxes trying to rule over dogs and wolves." It reminded me of these similes you often get in epic poetry with heroes. There'll be a hawk chasing down a deer or something. They're fierce. And maybe, I don't know, but maybe the wolf is a little bit of irony on Boudicca's part, because, of course, the she-wolf who fed Romulus and Remus, and now have the Britons become the fierce ones.
Okay.
Maybe I'm reading too much into that.
Depends how she is on her Roman mythology as well, so...
Well, apparently she knows all about Roman history and their system of education. So she also knows, as you say, in Dio's version, a lot about what's going on in the heart of Rome. And she uses this against the Romans. And basically she's kind of playing around with gender politics here, using this to attack Nero as being overly effeminate, which is something that, you know, if you read his life in Suetonius, this is not unfamiliar to you. Dio probably had read that life. So he puts into Boudicca's mouth that kind of critique that Nero was getting from Roman authors themselves. And she does this in the form of a prayer to presumably a local goddess called Andraste. She says, "I thank thee, Andraste, and call upon thee." It's a very old translation, but I think "thee" is actually the right kind of way to do it here, because it's a prayer. "I call upon thee as woman speaking to woman," girl power.
Same level as a god.
Yeah, well, yeah. "For I rule over no burden-bearing Egyptians as it did Nitocris, nor over trafficking Assyrians as did Semiramis." So these are Eastern peoples ruled over by a queen, but she's having a go at them as well, because they're not as tough as her lot, she's basically saying. "Much less over the Romans themselves, as did Messalina once, and afterwards Agrippina." Obviously, Messalina and Agrippina were empresses. They didn't have imperium, but she's saying... they ruled over Claudius, therefore they ruled over the Romans.
They kind of did.
There's a lot going into this. Yeah. Importantly, and now this Nero, who, though in name a man, is in fact a woman, basically starts to use all of these feminine adjectival endings and pronouns here, is proved by her singing, lyre playing, and beautification of the person. So this idea that because Nero cares about his appearance and he likes to appear on stage and plays music, obviously much too girly. "Nay, those whom I rule over are Britons, men that know not how to till the soil or ply a trade." So that's a good thing, apparently, but are thoroughly versed in the art of war and hold all things in common, even children and wives, so that the latter possesses the same valour as the men. Barbarian peoples, their strength is in war. They don't bother with farming. We know from archaeological evidence that this is not true of the Iceni. They were farmers. They had livestock. They had crops. They also had very sophisticated jewellery and crafts that they made. So if any of you ever gets to go to the British Museum again, I guess if you're in Britain, you might be able to do that quite easily, then they have a piece called the Snettisham Great Torque. It's really beautiful. It's gold alloy that's sort of like, I think it's 8 strands of metal rope that are twisted in that way that's very typical of Celtic jewellery.
Mm.
That comes from Iceni territory. So none of this is true. This is all rubbish that Dio's making up. It's a stereotype of barbarians that they care about nothing except war. And they even have women go to war, viz. Boudica. According to Boudica here, the reason the women are so tough is that they have this kind of communist system going on where you don't even have monogamous marriage. So you don't know who your parents are because they hold all the women in common and they're just kind of this loose collection of peoples who dedicate themselves to war. All of these things sound appalling to the Romans, of course. This goes against everything that they stand for, every form of morality. So there's lots going on here. I know this is Dio, not Tacitus, but we started out with the Romans behaving appallingly, treating a British royal family in a way that's really shameful. Underlying all of it is this terrible stereotyping of the barbarians as people who they really need the Romans to come and take them in hand. Not good to do it the way that those particular soldiers have been doing it, but still.
I think that's the most useful thing you can get out of these 4 chapters or so of Boudica's speech is what the Romans actually think about the Iceni / British barbarians. They're good on Roman history, not so much tilling the soil. So all of this, you know, goes down really well with the barbarian demographic, and they're all riled up and they grab their weapons and everything, and Rhiannon's running over from Wales as they speak, and off they go to attack the Roman veterans is the first stop. So we should kind of emphasize at this point that we should say at this point that there are not a lot of Roman troops in the area. They are off with Suetonius fighting in Wales, off Anglesey Way, didn't you say, I think?
Yeah.
This is a good time for Boudica and her barbarian brethren to make some ground attacking the nearby Roman territories.
Yes, exactly. And they go first for Colchester, Camulodunum, which is, remember, in the territory of the Trinovantes. So the Iceni and the Trinovantes gather together. We're told they have an army of 120,000. You know these numbers are always really loose. I've no idea whether it could possibly have been that many. I doubt it. I thought of you when I was rereading this, because there are all these omens of what's to come. And I know Matt loves an omen.
Do love a good omen.
The victory statue at Camulodunum fell, Tacitus says, for no apparent reason, with its back turned as if in retreat from the enemy. And then even better than that, I mean, a statue falling over, maybe it's just been put up badly, but strange noises are being heard all through the Roman town. Foreign voices shouting in the Senate House. He actually says in the Curia. They already have a Curia, a Senate House, this early on, which is interesting in itself. Wailing in the theatre. Also, they have a theatre. Apparitions in the Thames estuary. Very, very weird. It's like something of a horror film. And this bit particularly, the sea looked blood red, says Tacitus. And these ghostly human forms appear in it. So there's, I guess it's all the ancestors of the Britons coming back to take their revenge. I don't know. Anyway, it's very typical of the kind of omens that we often see in, say, Suetonius when an emperor is about to die.
So Camulodunum asks for help.
Yeah, they can see what's coming.
Sure.
And they've had the omens.
Yes. Well,
Decianus, Caedus Decianus, only sends them 200. They're auxiliaries, they're not infantry, and they don't have proper weapons, so they're really not very well armed to deal with this. Also, the other thing about what the Romans are building here, I mean, it is pretty early days, and they're not building fortified forts of any sort. So I guess when we think of the Romans in Britain, or I do anyway, Hadrian's Wall and the forts along there and Vindolanda. This is not what we've got at Camulodunum at all. There are no fortifications. There are these kind of civic buildings. There are theatres. There's a temple. They're going to have to use the temple indeed to hide in. So that's their stronghold. And, you know, temple is not the greatest stronghold. Also, I think this is in Tacitus, there are enemies within. So, you know, it's not just Romans. There's also lots of locals living in this town or working in it or whatever. And they're sabotaging the defense. So, you know, they'll dig a defensive ditch and these people are covering it up. When the instruction is given to gather all of the vulnerable people together and put the younger men in particular to face them, they're not doing that. They're kind of mingling people together so the vulnerable are left in danger. And of course, the result of all this is that the Britons are able to just cause enormous damage to this place and enormous loss of life. And Tacitus puts it well, as always. They were surrounded by a horde of barbarians. That's what he thinks of the Britons. Everything was pillaged or burned, but the temple in which the soldiers had gathered was subjected to a two-day blockade. So actually didn't do too badly, the temple, and then taken by storm. That's Tacitus, book 14, the Annals, chapter 32.
Okay, so by the time any substantive Roman forces come through there, it's pretty much wiped out a bit, isn't it?
The town has been devastated, and also the Britons are clearly on a high, put it like that. They're pumped up, I guess, because when the reinforcements, the real reinforcements come under Cerialis, a future governor of Britain and relative of the Emperor Vespasian, the Britons just wipe out all of his infantry, apparently kill all of the infantry that are sent, and he has to flee with the cavalry. So even when proper troops come, proper troops, they don't succeed against these Britons. And this, I think, would have been a terrifying read for a Roman reader, this idea that these people you think of as this disorganized barbarian horde can take on significant Roman forces.
Yeah, yeah. So how did Suetonius react then? Because news of this disaster must have reached him pretty quickly.
Yes, he leaves, I think he's in Deva, Chester by this point, so just outside of modern Wales, gets there down to Camulodunum along the very famous Roman road, Watling Street, which still runs through London, Londinium as the Romans call it. In fact, when Tacitus discusses this, this is the first time London is ever mentioned in a literary text. So this is kind of the beginning of London.
There you go.
Tacitus sort of says, well, it doesn't have the distinction of being a colonia. It's not a proper Roman-founded city.
No, he describes it as a bit of market square going on, and that's about it.
Yeah.
Really. And that Suetonius breezes through and kind of goes, meh, this isn't worth saving.
Yes, indeed. That's what's coming up. He's not going to stay around to save it. And indeed, Tacitus does say that it's famous for businessmen and saleable goods, which I think is still what London's famous for, isn't it? I don't know. So he goes through. He's bringing his troops in, the 14th Legion and a significant part of the 20th Legion. So he's got, say, a legion and a half. He gets them there fast by good old forced marches, the thing Caesar often talks about in the Gallic War, which means they don't get any sleep or they march double pace. When he gets to Londinium, he does decide, as you mentioned, that it's just too desperate. The rebels are overwhelming everyone. The 9th Legion that is already there has been virtually exterminated. So this is really looking like trouble. So he falls back to meet the legionaries and, according to Tacitus, decided on saving the overall situation by the sacrifice of a single town. So early in London's history, it's already being given up by the Romans.
Yeah.
And this is really sad. Tacitus tells us, to quote from chapter 33, the tearful lamentations of people begging his aid could not avert him from giving the signal to move out and taking only those able to accompany him. If you're not strong enough to march with the Roman army, you're just left there for the Iceni, for Boudicca to come down and destroy.
It gets quite kind of brutal.
It's going to get more brutal.
Yeah.
Because the third town that Boudicca and her forces take, notice we're not getting very much description of how this is done, really, which is kind of typical of ancient historiography. So Boudicca in charge of these forces, we don't get much of a sense of that described. We get the speech at the beginning. Dio does describe kind of the final battle a little bit, but we're just kind of told there's lots of slaughter. And that is part of this rhetorical trope of the barbarians. They just come in, and if they win, they just kill everyone.
Mm.
And that's exactly what is said about the third town that Boudica takes, which is called Verulamnium, which is St. Albans now. So this also gets sacked. The people are killed, and Tacitus very specifically says that Boudica takes no prisoners. None of them are taken as slaves, which is kind of the Roman practice usually. If you remember, we've read Caesar's Gallic Wars together. Caesar only does that kind of thing when it's a special punishment because that Gallic people tricked him or double-crossed him, or they've said there's a truce and then they've broken it.
Mm.
Normally, he's much more lenient. There's no leniency here.
But that's what sets the barbarians apart from the Romans, if you want to look at it that way as well.
It is part of that characterization, I think. Mm. So this is a pretty nasty quote. He says that they hastily resorted to slaughter, the gallows, burning and crucifixion, which I have to think they probably learned from the Romans. And he says this is because the barbarians revel in plunder and were averse to hard work. I guess they don't want to engage with having slaves, people you have to deal with and feed and things like that. I assume that's what he means.
Yeah.
They kind of want the quick buck, the quick prize. According to Tacitus, again, numbers, 70,000 Roman citizens and their allies were killed. People. So, seems like a big town.
All right. So now after that nice account, please wade into Dio if you like.
Yeah, Dio's even worse. So, yeah, if there's anyone of a tender disposition around, I would mute for a second here. And I feel like he is upping the ante. Remember, he's further away from this. He calls it indescribable slaughter. I'm just going to read out the quote here. This is from Dio, book 67, chapter 7. They hung up naked the noblest and most distinguished women and then cut off their breasts and sewed them to their mouths in order to make the victims appear to be eating them. Afterwards, they impaled the women on sharp skewers run lengthwise through the entire body. All this they did to the accompaniment of sacrifices, banquets, and wanton behaviour, not only in all their other sacred places, but particularly in the grove of Andarte. That's the goddess that Boudica was praying to before battle. This was their name for victory, and they regarded her with the most exceptional reverence. So this is like a big perversion of everything that's sacred and religious, that they're doing these appalling things, and of course doing it to noble Romans and noble Roman women is particularly disgusting.
I've got a couple of comments to say about that, but I think that I will save them for after we see the Romans' victory, because that might put the amount of barbarism we get into context a little bit as to why the Romans react the way they do. Anyway, Suetonius has essentially left all of these areas to fend for themselves in order to get his men into a good position. It's a very clinical kind of reaction, a way of engaging the barbarians to make sure that you're giving yourself an assured victory. Is that a good way to look at it?
Yeah, I think that's right, isn't it? That Tacitus tells us that that's the decision he makes. That's the equation that he decides on. He does kind of choose the location for what turns out to be the final battle very specifically. He's doing this very strategically. So in Annals 1444, we're told that Suetonius selected a narrow location and he had the cover of a wood to the rear. And he made sure there was no trace of an enemy except to the front. So he's in a good position where they can't attack from behind. And that there's a big plain in front of him devoid of cover, which won't allow for an ambush. So he's chosen the field of battle. We don't know where this is. So much ink being spilled over this. The most convincing thing I've read is somewhere in the Midlands, which, I know Britain isn't the biggest country in the world, but that's still pretty vague. Yeah, we're not sure. North of Londinium.
But assumably, if you found that area, there'd be a lot of interesting metal bits to find, wouldn't there? You'd think that somebody out there with a metal detector will stumble across it someday.
There's a lot of battlefields in Britain. Yeah. Maybe, but it could be under a tower block, couldn't it?
Car park. What are you going to do? Sure.
Or a car park, yes. Everything in Britain that's important is under a car park. The British forces are, of course, really, they've had so many victories that now they are depicted as moving jubilantly in every direction, says Tacitus. They're kind of out of control, high on what they've accomplished. And they've brought their wives to watch as well, which, oh, you know, that's something Tacitus says that the Germani do, the Germanic peoples. Clearly there and here, he thinks it's very strange.
Yeah.
Very, very weird that women would be involved in warfare at all. And I guess it kind of also underlines the fact that Boudica isn't just watching, she's in charge of these troops, so even weirder.
Yeah, I don't think he makes enough of that, really. So the Romans are very outnumbered, so we've got 10,000, apparently, facing 100,000, apparently, supposedly. The Romans have their training and discipline, and now in chapters 36 and 37 of Tacitus, we get Boudica making a speech to her troops, followed by Suetonius making a speech to his troops. I like that they kind of both balanced each other out a bit, that they were both convincing and a bit rousing, and also that, you know, they weren't laying it on too thick. They were manageable length for poor little me to comprehend.
They're not actually speeches. They're in indirect speech, at least Boudica's is. You're right, they are shortish. I mean, compared to the speeches that Dio gives her. Mm. Everything seems short, I guess. I'm going to read a bit of Boudica's indirect speech. And I think what the speeches do, by the way, is, for one thing, we've been told the Romans are totally outnumbered. So, you know, a bit of tension there. Mm. And the speeches kind of delay the conflict itself and build up. This is what the barbarians think of themselves. It's shocking for the Roman reader, I'm sure. Now, this is how we get this version of Boudica. Boudica rode in a chariot with her daughters before her. We'll talk about that again. And she approached each tribe. As she approached each tribe, she declared that while it was quite normal for the Britons to fight under a woman's command, apparently, she was not on that occasion seeking vengeance for a kingdom and possessions as a woman descended from great ancestors. So she reminds them of that. But that's not why she's fighting. No, she said. She sought it as one of the people sought it for liberty lost, a flogging received, and the sexual abuse of her daughters.
This is personal.
Yeah, it's personal for her. But of course, she says she's fighting as one of the people. But she added, the gods were with them to exact their just revenge. The legion that had dared to engage had been destroyed. So talk about past victories, always mm-hmm. good in a speech. The others were hiding in their camp or looking for around for an escape. So we've got the Romans on the run, is what she's saying. They wouldn't even stand up to the roar and shouts of so many thousands of men, much less to their charge and their sword arms. This is playing on the idea that the barbarians sound so rowdy, they often scare the Romans. And, you know, usually that will be turned around because in the fighting, they kind of can't live up to that. Although, so far, Boudica's troops have. If they themselves assessed their own troop numbers and their motives for war, she said, then in an engagement, they had to win or fall. So it's kind of all or nothing for the Romans, yeah. She's saying. This was the decision a woman had taken. Let the men live on and be slaves. So she's kind of saying to them, if you don't fight, you're kind of less than me. I'm a woman and I've decided this. If you don't fight, then you've given way to slavery.
Okay.
Tacitus always has to bring in slavery. Suetonius, Tacitus makes it sound like he's coming from a position of kind of almost desperation in a way. He says, though he had confidence in the valor of his men, he nonetheless delivered a mixture of exhortation and pleas. So he's pleading with them to fight. I feel that's never a good position to be in.
Mm.
Urging them to pay no heed to the barbarians' noise and empty threats. There were more women than young men visible among them. So he's using that gender against Boudica and her troops there. Always playing upon this idea that the barbarians make a lot of noise, but can they live up to that? And the noise is potentially terrifying to the enemy.
Yeah.
That they have to try and ignore that. So it's like he's trying to overcome their fears. Lacking fighting ability and weapons, they would immediately give ground when they recognized the arms and courage of their conquerors. And then he says, I'm just going to cut to the end here. They should just keep close order and after discharging their javelins, continue the bloody slaughter with shield bosses and swords with no thought for plunder. Don't stop to pick things up. You can do that at the end. Everything would come to them when victory was won. So I do think Suetonius is made to sound a little bit desperate here.
Yeah, not the most rousing speech. And also Boudica and the barbarians are made to sound like a rowdy bunch of football fans at a match.
You're saying that's what the Brits have always been.
Well, I mean, you said it, not I. Yeah, no, it's a very weird kind of speech from who is meant to be your hero of this, i.e. Suetonius.
I don't think it's ever as simple as that, though. It's very complicated in Tacitus in particular. Boudica certainly has cause, but she's not in charge of a kind of reasoned, trained bunch like the Romans are. So, you know, in the end, the barbarians never win in these encounters as described by Romans, or very, very rarely. And when they do, it's a big deal. There can be a certain amount of almost empathy with their position. I mean, it's been theorized that Boudica, it's not so much about the position of the Britons here, that when Tacitus writes about her, he's actually writing, this gets a bit complicated and mind-binding, he's writing about how the senatorial class has to deal with someone like Nero or an emperor who's a despot. So, you know, how do you fight for your liberty in that kind of situation? Or this is kind of a parallel situation that Romans themselves find themselves in, because all of the time we get emphasized, you know, Boudica's high status. She herself says it. It's been set out from the start. So she's got rights that should be fought for, but there's somebody in charge who's not prepared to let that happen. You could read it like that. I mean, Tacitus is kind of always talking about tyranny, whatever he talks about. So I don't think it's completely out of the question.
All right. So we've got the Romans on one side being very ordered and organized and well-armed. And on the other side, we've got the barbarians, the Britons, being very loud and rabble-ish. Is that a word? With their women watching on / participating. And Boudica riled up there in her chariot with her daughters. And Tacitus kind of brushes it all off as going, yep, the Romans win. Tacitus is very brief on his recount here. The British run towards the Romans. The Romans throw a few missiles at them. No one was spared. Women, animals, all killed. The number he gives is a little less than 80,000 Britons fell, and at the cost of some 400 Romans killed. So that's the final score in the match.
Yeah, and it's a wipeout, so that kind of harks back to what you were mentioning before about the brutality of the Britons when they're destroying Roman towns.
That there's retribution involved, maybe. And we do get more details from Dio, though.
Well, he also portrays the Britons as these very loud barbarians. He says the armies approached each other, and he gives us two polar opposites. The barbarians with much shouting mingled with menacing battle songs. The Romans silently and in order until they came within a javelin's throw of the enemy, so they're more contained. Then, while their foes were still advancing against them at a walk, the Romans rushed forward at a signal and charged them at full speed, and when the clash came, easily broke through the opposing ranks. But he still gives us tension, because there's so many more Britons that he says the Romans have to be fighting everywhere at once. It's quite cinematic. You can imagine you go from one scene to another. Light-armed troops exchanged missiles with light-armed. Heavy-armed were opposed to heavy-armed. Cavalry clashed with cavalry. And this is the bit I like. Against the chariots, they love the fact that they've got chariots, of the barbarians, the Roman archers contended. Because I guess if you're an infantry soldier, you don't want to get in the way of a chariot. But archers can deal with them from a distance. The barbarians would assail the Romans with a rush of their chariots, knocking them helter-skelter. Good use of helter-skelter. But since they fought with breastplates, would themselves be repulsed by the arrows. Even the chariots aren't necessarily a sure way to success. He kind of gives us this, I don't know if it is that much more detail. It's quite an impressionistic account of the battle. This was all this skirmishing going on at the same time.
It's like the Bayeux tapestry version of it all.
maybe, yeah. Anyway, it goes on for a long time. Both parties, he says, were animated with the same zeal and daring. So it's all very exciting. But finally, late in the day, the Romans prevailed. And they slew many in battle beside the wagons and the forest and captured many alike. So he actually says that they captured many and not just wiped them all out.
Yeah.
Different account. Also different for the end for Boudica in Tacitus and Dio, which is really striking. And makes me think there were different versions of this. So Tacitus says that she kills herself by poisoning, which is, of course, what a highborn Roman would do, you know, rather than be executed, take it into their own hands. And we know, for example, Seneca did that when told to kill himself by Nero. But Dio, rather less dramatically, says that she fell sick and died. Possibly she was wounded. He doesn't even tell us that. Just fell sick and died all of a sudden.
That could be committing suicide by poisoning, though, by a different translation. I don't know.
It's very nonspecific if it is. We have a suicide on the Roman side as well. A man called Poinius Postumus, who's the camp prefect of the 2nd Legion, who kills himself out of shame because he hadn't joined in the battle and so denied his own men a victory. I think Tacitus puts that in to show us that shame is really important on both sides, that if you feel you've been defeated or you haven't been part of the victory, that's an equal amount of disgrace, and therefore suicide is an appropriate reaction.
Maybe we have more in common with the barbarians than we thought, men. That kind of attitude.
Yeah, maybe.
And yet another tally to add to our confusing count here. Dio says 80,000 Romans and allies perish, and the island lost to Rome. All this ruin was brought about upon the Romans by a woman, a fact which in itself caused the greatest shame.
He's being really overdramatic. I mean, the Romans stay in Britannia. They've actually won this battle, and it remains a Roman colony, and indeed, they move further north, and, you know, they eventually get so far north, they have a wall in northern England, and at one point they're even beyond that. So there's a second wall in southern Scotland. And, you know, they're there until the 4th century, so Dio, he didn't know of a time when they weren't in Britain. Yeah. he's long dead by the time the Romans leave.
Okay. We'll be taking a couple of questions from you lovely audience members soon. But just before we get to that, I think that part of what Dio says there is quite important. The fact that Boudica was a woman was a great shame to the Romans. So what did the Romans think of Boudica herself, and was it significant that she was a woman that is giving them this sort of resistance and standing up to them?
Yeah, I mean, they find it very strange, as I've mentioned, that a woman would take command, and particularly take command in a military situation. So while Tacitus is writing about this in this same work, you know, he's writing about exactly what Dio mentions, how appalling it is that Agrippina rocks up at the Senate and makes it look like she's as entitled to be there as Claudius is. They perceive having their woman problem back home. Meanwhile, out in Britannia, there's a woman who's out on the battlefield challenging Roman legions. It's a real shock to their sense of propriety, especially for, let's face it, these entitled elite Roman males who sort of see it as their right to be ruling, and they've had the rug taken from under them a little bit by the fact that they're now living in an empire, under an emperor. But the fact that a woman could challenge this too, I mean, Dio kind of gives her a backhanded compliment. He says she's a woman of the royal family possessed of greater intelligence than often belongs to women.
I'm laughing, but that's terrible.
Yeah. There's sort of admiration. There's often admiration for the toughness of the barbarians as a whole. And I guess there's an extra boundary here. There's an extra barrier because it's not just about being non-Roman, non-Greek or Roman, not civilized in their view, but also not being a man in charge. There's always this gender confusion there. And what it means is that in Dio in particular, he's kind of obsessed with her appearance and gives us kind of the version that we have of Boudica, I suppose. There's a lot of obsession with barbarians' appearance, northern barbarians, describing them as big and tough and hairy. And Dio says of her, in stature, she was very tall. In appearance, most terrifying. So that scariness comes up again. In the glance of her eye, most fierce. So she looks at you and you're kind of done for. And her voice was harsh. A great mass of the tawniest, bear that word in mind, hair fell to her hips. So very long hair. Around her neck was a large golden necklace. Maybe like that talk, although archaeologists disagree that that would be appropriate.
It could be hers. It could be hers.
And she wore a tunic of diverse colours. Well, that's kind of, you know, impressive for barbarians, having coloured dyes, over which a thick mantle was fastened with a brooch. That kind of gives us the stereotype of her as this massive red-headed barbarian. The word that Dio actually uses is difficult because Greek and Latin, their colour terms don't really match easily with ours. So the word he uses, I think, is xanthus, which means more blonde, to be honest.
Okay.
But there's a kind of maybe a reddy strawberry blondeness. But we have decided she's redheaded, I think because we've decided that red hair is, I don't know, can be associated with angry women or something like that. I've always wanted to have red hair, so I'm jealous. But this idea that it's kind of fiery, you know, there's a fieriness that comes with red hair. I think that's part of the stereotype.
Mm.
It's not exactly the way Dio describes her. But still, this idea that she's big, she's impressive, she's imposing. If we've got a picture of Boudicca in your mind, that's probably the way she's portrayed.
Yeah.
Always with this long hair flying out, kind of disorderly and, as I say, very impressive.
There's a small voice in the back of my head going, I don't recall Dio speaking about like Vercingetorix's appearance this much, or Arminius or anybody else who fought against the Romans. We don't get big long paragraphs about, you know, the brooch that they wore and the fastenings that they had and the colour of their hair or anything like that.
Yeah, it hasn't stopped, has it?
Surprising for me to say for somebody who lives so long ago, he's very old-fashioned.
I mean, I've heard women who are newsreaders say that their appearance is always commented on.
Yeah,
They're women, what they wear, that kind of thing. So I think that's still happening. And I'm not saying it's exactly the same, because I don't think the dynamics here are exactly the same in antiquity. But I think that because there is a certain amount of objectification going on, that, yeah, we get descriptions of Cleopatra, we get descriptions of Boudicca, we get descriptions of Roman women who kind of step outside the bounds in particular. So this is fairly typical. But I would say that the Romans are also keen on describing the barbarians. So if you read Tacitus's Germania, he talks about the appearance of the German peoples, and they are similarly big and strong and kind of lumbering. And he talks a lot about how this means that they can stand cold, but they can't stand heat. So he's got this weird kind of environmental determinism going on, and this means that they're fierce, but they're not very clever, that kind of thing. So appearance comes into it because she's a barbarian and because she's a woman. She's kind of doubly tarred there.
Mm. Okay. And I guess as a way of wrapping up, what has Boudicca meant down the centuries? And that there's kind of two ways to take this. One is what she has meant to the British people, and maybe also as a symbol of resistance.
Her image kind of seems to have come to the fore in Britain, maybe in the later 18th century into the 19th century. And it's very much at that point kind of wrapped up with British imperialism. So earlier on, she'll turn up sometimes, I think, as a figure who's there as some kind of unified British leader. I mean, she wasn't. It's two or three southern British tribes that she leads. That's often kind of conflated with this idea that she's a national hero. But that comes particularly to the fore when the British have their own empire. And as I say, it's ironic because she becomes this figure of British imperialism and kind of indomitable spirit. Nowhere seen more so, I think, than what was used to advertise this talk, the statue by Thornycroft on the banks of the Thames, where she is in her chariot, that very imposing black statue. She's in her chariot with her two daughters and, you know, her hair flailing back, looking absolutely indomitable, with the scythes on the wheels, which are definitely anachronistic. That statue was designed during the reign of Victoria. I think it wasn't actually put up until the early 20th century. But it has a quote on it, which comes from an 18th century poem about Boudicca by the poet Cooper, from Boadicea, an ode. So underneath the statue, it says, "Regions Caesar never knew, thy posterity shall sway." So the idea that places that the Romans never went to, Britain rules over, all right? Thy posterity, we as the descendants of Boudicca, we have power over them. So it's about empire, that statue. And of course, she was fighting empire, if you read Tacitus and Dio. So it's a paradox. She featured in a lot of 19th century literature. There's a very long and I think a little bit tedious poem by Tennyson, who was the poet laureate in the 19th century. I think she gets aligned with Victoria as, you know, the Empress of India and the queen of a huge empire, which is weird because Victoria is always portrayed as, I think, more or less self-contained and very proper. And Boudicca, at least in the ancient versions of her, is kind of out of control.
Mm.
But somehow that kind of misalignment doesn't matter. She's still a British icon. So 19th century, she is specifically this figure of British strength. And then in the 20th century, I think it's her femininity that comes to the fore, or maybe her womanhood. So she's adopted by, say, suffragettes as a figure. I like this quote from one of the suffragettes, Dora Montefiore. She says, "Boadicea in her chariot always appeared to me to be advancing threateningly on the Houses of Parliament." So she's referring to that Thornycroft statue.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was therefore a symbol of the attitude towards Parliament of us military women.
Sure,
she describes the suffragettes as military women. It's a lovely reading of Boadicea and that particular representation.
It's like the next Night of the Museum movie. She's going to come to life and go across the Houses of Parliament. And
I hope so. Sort them out. She's there as again in second wave feminism in the 60s and 70s. So Judy Chicago, the artist, has her in this installation called The Dinner Party in the 1970s. And I think it's not just because of that statue, but certainly in London, that's something that dominates the banks of the Thames. Apparently Banksy recently wheel clamped her chariot.
Yeah, why not? Sure.
And he said, actually, he put out a statement saying that was because the things you see every day, you sort of forget and they don't have meaning anymore. So this is a way of reminding you it was there almost.
Yeah.
Of making it a bit different, of pointing it out. I think it remained there for a few weeks, the clamp.
Okay.
So there you go. That's where we are with Boudicca now.
Okay. It's interesting that she, and if you look at people like Arminius and Vercingetorix, they become a symbol of unity and empire when, if you read the texts, none of them are portrayed that way. They are resisting Roman Empire. They are resisting the Roman influence. All of them have become something else. I guess more of a symbol of where they come from rather than what they're standing for.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of bound to happen, isn't it? In our current kind of formulation of having nation states. And so we have people as symbols of those nations. Mm. So when we build a statue, it's kind of a statue to that national identity in many ways, or what we want to show about ourselves. I mean, if you put a statue of Boudicca up now, it would be quite different, I'm sure. Their meaning changes over time, like everything else. But it's interesting that she is still meaningful to Britain in particular. And in fact, that's why we put this recording on at this time. Because sorry to you in North America, we did think of a time that was good for you. And then we thought, oh, but that's really bad for Britain and that might not look great.
Yeah, no, they might want to hear this recording. Okay, I guess that's about it. We've got one question in the Q&A from Philip Lillingston saying, how much of the whipping of Boudicca and the rape of her daughters was the decision of Rome rather than that of the junior officers left in charge of East Anglia? I kind of think that it would have been a local spare of the moment decision, if anything.
Yeah, we can't answer that question definitively, but the fact that Tacitus has Suetonius begging his troops to act in a certain way might tell us that he doesn't have total control over them. And of course, he's not there anyway. I mean, Tacitus doesn't give us a reason why this suddenly happens. I'm guessing because it happens when Prasutagus dies, that the implication is that the Romans now see his kingdom as weak, so they can do what they want. So there's this idea that there's always this tension, and if there's not a protector there, then this is the kind of thing that could happen, which is a pretty sad indictment on the Roman army, if that's true. Mm. But of course, he doesn't have a male heir, and Tacitus does stress that his daughters, and so the Romans perceive them as weak. And I guess the outcome of it all is they were wrong to think that because Boudicca is not weak.
Yeah.
But all of that is really speculation on my part. We do know that the Roman troops, when they were told they could take plunder, that's the kind of thing that would happen. And I think would have been accepted. But this is not the appropriate time for plunder. That sounds like a terrible attitude, but I think it might have been the attitude of the Roman commanders.
No, considering that, you know, you just had the king die and leave some of his territory to Caesar and everything. These are friendlies. You don't do that to friendlies.
It's a diplomatic error. Well, if you want to gloss over it in the most...
Whoops, I made a diplomatic error.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got a question here from Mark Temtemi. Where had Paulinus, which is Suetonius, gained his experience? Ah, well, for the answer to that, look out for our upcoming podcast mini-series on Agricola. Yeah, Rhiannon?
Yeah, he gets a mention or two there.
I'm actually being serious there. We're three or four episodes into recording it, so it's coming soon. Jennifer Wien asks why the change in pronunciation, and I gather this is with Boudicca's name.
Mm. When I was a child, long, long ago, she was always Boadicea. We think Boudicca is probably the way she would have pronounced it. Oh, this is when we were on pretty shaky ground there, I think, in thinking we know very much about ancient British language and pronunciation. There are different spellings in Tacitus and Dio, and I think that leads to some of the confusion. So the way that we write it now, Boudicca, is much closer to Tacitus. I think he might have one C. Whereas Dio, writing in Greek, he's writing it as Boudicca. That's the way it looks, and it's with a kappa, of course, not a C.
Yeah.
Part of it is this is what we do to pronunciation. So we've decided to try and pronounce Boudicca's name more like she might have pronounced it. We have not decided to do that with Julius Caesar. We have, I don't know what you want to call it, anglicized it and left it like that. So maybe the fact that we're making more effort with Boudicca is a testament to her as a British icon. But she's been through other pronunciations. It might not sound like it, but B and V, kind of swap places a lot through time. And so sometimes it's, and this is true of early English versions, I think around the 10th or 11th century, we have an account where she's Vuda or Voda.
Yeah.
So there are even more.
Okay. We have a question from Heather Wallace saying, how long did it take Londinium to recover socially and economically after it was sacked by the Iceni?
Wow. I would say probably not very long. And the fact that Tacitus describes it as this kind of bustling business center suggests to me that that's what it had become again during his lifetime.
Yeah.
So in the early second century, it's getting back there. It's kind of inevitable because it's on the Thames and the Romans are trading things in and out of that estuary. So I don't think it would take very long. The Romans just need to be back in control.
We have an anonymous question here. Tacitus generally writes about powerful women in a very negative way, but there seems to be admiration for Boudicca. Is this because she's not Roman and therefore held to different standards?
Well, yes, because she matters less. That's an awful thing to say, but she's not going to challenge the center of power. She's not like Agrippina. She's not holding sway over the emperor. Therefore, she's not as much of a danger. Also, she's dead. It's kind of neutralized. And in his version, she dies in a really admirable way. So this is a kind of heroic way to die, to take it into your own hands. I guess it's a bit of a chicken and egg. Does he give her that death because he admires her, or does he admire her because that's what he's heard of how she died? I think that he can only admire her because she's been neutralized, which is a rather depressing answer to that. But yeah, it is different for non-Roman women because they're already a bit weird. You know, Britons do things like that. So absolutely, there are different standards.
Final cheery question that we've got here. What became of Boudicca's daughters from Kathy Bromley? Nothing good, we assume.
We don't hear about them again. If you take that as they were killed, which is not unlikely, is it?
Mm.
Then that may be what happened. Maybe they escaped. Maybe somebody already has written a novel.
I'm actually slightly surprised that there's no, like, I'm glad there isn't a Boudicca Disney movie or something like that. I'm surprised she isn't a Disney princess by now.
It would have to be made considerably less violent.
Yeah,
but they could do that.
They've done that with everything. All right. One last question for us to finish on. Sorry. Jonathan Rowland has just put in, how much of Boudicca's presentation in the sources is history, and how much of it is a morality tale told to shame or spur moral improvement in the Roman audience? In that sense, how much can we actually know about the historical Boudicca?
Yeah, I think this is, I was going to say this is particularly the case for Tacitus, but actually it's there in Dio so strongly too, that it's both of them, that this is, like a lot of ancient historiography, a way of telling a Roman reader how they should behave, or the correct way for a Roman to behave. And I don't think that means that we can't know anything about Boudica, because I think there has to be a certain amount of this kind of skeleton of her story to build that on. But the kind of emphasis we get, I mean, even just having two versions, we can see that an author can lay very different emphasis on one thing or another. So while Tacitus is obsessed with freedom and slavery, Dio kind of zones in much more on, I guess, gender dysphoria is how he feels. Anyway, it's dysphoria for him. He's not happy with the way Nero and Boudica behave. They use that tale to bring out these kind of exemplars, these positive or negative exemplars. But I don't think we should think that the Romans only did that in their history. We know that they did do research. We know that Tacitus could have talked to Agricola, would have talked to Agricola about this. We know that he could have read Paulinus's memoir. We know that he might well have had access to some imperial libraries and documents. And Dio, you know, immensely well read. And we have lost so many sources that there's probably a lot more feeding into that than just, I'm going to use this to tell you how awful the barbarians are, or how the Roman army can misbehave, and how we need to get our act together if we're going to be true Romans. So it's a balancing act. We can kind of take both from it, and we can't know exactly what is true. We can never know that with history, but we do have to be aware that Romans use history for that, to moralize in that way.
On that note, we might call it an evening or a morning or a afternoon, depending where you are. Good morning to North America. Good evening to Australia. And cheerio to good old Britannia.
Good night. Thanks so much for joining us. It's always fun to do these.
That was Dr. Rhiannon Evans, head of the Department of Languages and Linguistics at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighborhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on our Facebook page, and you can follow both of us on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You have been fantastic, and thanks for listening.